a lot of, whoops, did I lose you? Nope. Okay. A lot of really overt racism that I had not experienced growing up. A lot of anti-Semitism that I hadn't experienced growing up. Like, that neighborhood is like basically like half Orthodox Jews, half mostly not Jewish African-American folks, and then like some white Latinx folks that are like in the mix. Anyway, I'm really taking a long time to tell you my story, but like, I think all of those things kind of led me to where I am, that I, at different points in that work, like took a job working as the school community liaison because I naively was like, I'm gonna like show everyone that the Jewish community is not all racist and self-interested, and I'm gonna raise money for the schools, and I'm gonna like help make things better, and I'm gonna bring people together and whatever. And very quickly realized a lot of things. One, in some of the schools that I was working with, my presence was very unwelcome. And I was like met with a lot of anti-Semitism and a lot of just resistance and skepticism about my presence, which I at the time as a really stupid young person was like, but I'm so nice. Like, why does everybody hate me? And I needed to learn about communal histories and very legitimate reasons why the Black community would be concerned about a white Jewish woman being in the school and like what my motives might be. I also learned $5,000 or $10,000 wasn't going to change anything at the schools, like looking at budgets and needing to decide whether we could have an assistant principal at a K-8 school or a class of 48 kids. And like, that's the trade-off, was like shocking, having grown up at a school down the road. I'm at my parents' house right now, which was brand new when I went as a second grader. And similarly, like seeing the condition of the buildings. And I worked on a 3-year campaign, the 21st Century Schools campaign with the Baltimore Education Coalition. I got my organization to join that, organized parents and community members to fight for almost $1 billion to rebuild or renovate a chunk of Baltimore City schools, which unfortunately has not gone far enough. And that was a 3-year campaign. It was my first experience like really doing organizing work. My first experience really doing direct lobbying. And I just couldn't believe, like, it was so incredible to be like at a rally with 3,000 people that we organized to be there. And to, at the end of a 3-year campaign, win like the largest public investment in Baltimore City, in the schools like ever. I knew I wanted to do more of that work, but as a white Jewish woman, like where there's like trying to determine an appropriate role for myself in movement work in Baltimore was really challenging. I also, you know, I started doing a bunch of anti-racism education for like seeking out trainings for myself, which really changed my interest and like what I thought was work that I would be doing that would positively contribute, kind of like abandoning possibilities that were very, rooted in like white saviorism and stuff like that. And I was just feeling, I also had led a, like multiracial dialogue group with Blacks and Jews, some Black Jews, some not Black not Jewish Black folks, some Orthodox folks, some like kind of Jewish folks that are like more my observance level that lived in the neighborhood. So I did that for a year and really did see growth in people that I kind of almost had no hope in. Like their ideas were just so racist and so ignorant and just completely oblivious to other people's experience and how systems impact people differently. And I did see like really significant change in people, which shocked me and my colleague. So anyway, I was really lost. I'd been at Chai for 7 years. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I once a week would like half-heartedly look for jobs and saw this job, which was to create the Baltimore branch of Jews United for Justice. And it felt like it was coming from heaven, honestly. Like it was like, like this is the thing. Like this is the work I want to be doing, right? Like it's doing racial and economic justice work, but it's organizing my community. And so I can be in a leadership role and it's appropriate. My friend, Karen Moratz, who runs Jewish Community Action in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. So it's a very similar organization to JOFJ, talks about our job as being one of making the Jewish community capable of helping to bring about the change that we want to see in the world. So it's not just about doing the work, but it's also about educating our community and bringing them into the work to help contribute. And that in Baltimore in particular can be a really uphill battle sometimes. The Baltimore Jewish community is just very different from the DC Jewish community that I grew up in. It's much more politically conservative. It's the largest Orthodox Jewish population per capita in the country. And that has a huge effect on the community's politics, which make it much more right-wing and conservative than the DC Jewish community. And I through the work, like really found my people. Like I worked for the Jewish community for 7 years and didn't really feel like I had a Jewish community that was like aligned with my values. And I kind of collected those people. And so 7 years, so 6 years later, it'll be 6 years in like a couple weeks, there's a new synagogue here that I belong to called the Hinenu, the Baltimore Justice Shtiebel. Shtiebel is like a word, a Yiddish word for like small synagogue. And that community is so radical. Like they just adopted, we just adopted police and prison abolition as like our issue for the year to be like learning about and doing activism around. It's like super, the rabbi's partner is trans and there are tons of like genderqueer people in the community and trans people and like just people with so many different identities. I think it tends to be a much more welcoming place for people, for Jews of color. It's incredible. And it's not something I would have thought possible 6 years ago. So I think that's kind of the Jewish piece of my work. I don't know if this is way more than you wanted and now you have questions for me or how you wanna.
Honestly, you could keep, it's fascinating, truly an incredible story. I was wondering in that case, because Jews United for Justice seems to be extremely radical, actually. And so how difficult or how easy was it to sort of collect those people that you felt were right for this kind of work? And how has the community received you all?
I think the hardest part of my job, because one of the things I didn't say is like critical to our work is relationships with people who are much more directly impacted than our community tends to be, who are leading the work. And having those relationships and maintaining them and like really requires being aligned. And so like being fairly radical, although we would never like really publicly talk about our work that way. We talk about ourselves as a progressive organization. But the reality is that I think we talk about a lot like that our job is to be translators for our community, to like take ideas, I say, to take radical ideas, other people say, like to take ideas that are new or uncomfortable for people, and make them, translate them to be hearable to people, to explain them in a way that people can really hear and can process, and hopefully get on board with. So having to walk the line of really upholding those values and being aligned with our partners on their demands while still being welcomed or at least accepted by the mainstream Jewish community is really hard. It's sort of a constant struggle, it requires a constant vigilance. It requires a lot of relationship building. I think it helped a lot that I worked for the Associated, you know, like Chai is part of the Associated system, the Jewish Federation in Baltimore. So I was there for 7 years. I have a lot of relationships in the community, like and the Associated is the only, I think, North American Jewish Federation that's still centralized. In other places, like here in DC, each organization is sort of autonomous and they're connected, but they're not part of the same thing. And in Baltimore, it is still very centralized. So, you know, if the Baltimore Jewish Council, for example, says like, the Baltimore Jewish Council can say to other organizations, don't work with this organization. Baltimore Jewish Council is like the political arm of the Associated. And they sort of feel like they have to listen to that. So sometimes we have to take the position we need to take and know that that's going to mean that there's some level of consequence. So for example, one of our first funders, who I will not name, said, so they gave us like $15,000 the first year. And when I met with our program officer there, he was like, so make sure you don't do anything controversial. And I should also say like all of our, most of our funders throughout our history in Baltimore have been like Jewish foundations, and we're taking money from their like Jewish life pool, which I feel really great about, because it's like taking money for the community and still contributing to the community. It's building Jewish community and providing Jewish experiences for people, but it also is contributing to like the greater good. Anyway, so Jewish organization, Jewish foundation said, you know, don't do anything controversial. So I was like, well, do you mean don't do anything like countering the position of the Baltimore Jewish Council? Or do you mean like don't do anything that's going to upset Jewish business owners? And he said, well, avoid both scenarios. So I was like, okay. And I called my boss after and I was cracking up. Like I was just like, this is not possible. So I don't know, like we're just gonna do what we're gonna do. And if they don't like it, then they can stop funding us, which is ultimately what happened. They were just like, you know, you're too progressive for us and we'll give you $5,000 so this is our second year. Like we'll give you $5,000 this year and we're not funding you at all next year. And we're fine, you know, that's okay. The founding story of JFJ is actually rooted in a similar thing where they were working with Unite Here in DC to stand with workers who were being mistreated and like weren't able to, were having trouble negotiating with the owner, Jewish guy, of a, what's it called? valet parking service, which all the synagogues in DC use because it's hard to park in DC. And that's like the day that, you know, high holidays, everyone goes to synagogue. And the guy who owned the business was livid that JFJ was participating. We had sent an email or a letter to all of the synagogues and said, like, don't use this company. They're in an active labor dispute. And the guy flipped out and threatened JFJ. And we had just applied for our first grant from the Jewish Federation in DC, where he was on the board. And we did not, you know, desist from the work. Unite Here held a fundraiser for JFJ. Ultimately, we won the campaign. He negotiated with the workers. And we did get the grant from the Federation. So like that was one of the reasons that I really was excited to work for JFJ, to know that I was working for a place that wouldn't compromise its values for the bottom line, which was not my experience previously. So, yeah, so I think like that has been the challenge. I think the best way I've found to get access to the synagogues and access to the associated system and recruit and build relationships in those spaces has been through education. And I kind of had to push my executive director on the education piece. He was like, why are you spending so much time on educational programming that doesn't necessarily connect to our campaigns directly, like how to talk to family and friends about racism, or you know, screening PBS's Race, the Power of an Illusion documentary and talking about it, or, you know, things that are ultimately connected to our work very closely, but aren't about, like, it's not a film screening about police reform. But I think that, and the organization has shifted and it is now part of our strategic plan to really center that education, because it's critical. Like, if we can't, it's what Karen was saying about, like, helping the Jewish community to be capable of helping to bring about the change we want to see in the world. And if they don't understand the issues, if they don't understand their own racism and the racism that exists in our country, they can't, and the world, they can't contribute effectively. That's been the easiest way, is to say, like, let's do a program about whatever, you know, that's not necessarily connected to a campaign. And that then there's like a base of people in that congregation that want to learn more, that want to be more involved. So at this point we have a synagogue social justice roundtable that we convene with 11 congregations or chavarot, which are like informal prayer groups kind of. They don't have rabbis. They meet in people's houses when there's not a pandemic. And they meet like every other month and talk about what social justice work they're doing in their congregations, what's JFJ doing, and sort of finding opportunities for collaboration. So, you know, this Sunday we're hosting a meeting with Councilman Julian Jones and Councilman Izzy Patoka in Baltimore County to talk about police reform. And it's being hosted by JFJ and Chizuk Emunah, which is the largest conservative synagogue in Baltimore. And like the fact that, like, and this is not solely because of JFJ's work, but it's certainly a part of the transformation, that synagogue signed onto a letter with 400 other congregations, a letter like about the importance of like standing in solidarity with Black Lives Matter, and that like that's something that they're committed to, and they put up a sign that says Black Lives Matter, which is really controversial in a more conservative Jewish community, because there's a lot, like Zionism, anti-Zionism is often equated with anti-Semitism. And so the Black Lives Matter platform years ago, including language about Israel and about genocide and apartheid, like made people berserk in the Jewish community, at least a portion of the Jewish community. And so, you know, the fact that they have taken that step to do that, like it's obviously symbolic and whatever, but it's a choice that they have to really defend and are being attacked for. And I, again, like, that's never something I would have expected 6 years ago. Another multiple big synagogues are doing that. Baltimore Hebrew Congregation is putting up a sign. Beth Am in Reservoir Hill put up a sign, which is more believable 6 years ago. But yeah, so it's hard, but I think relationships are the key thing. Anytime something's gone wrong, it's because I reflect and it's like, this would not have been as bad if I had had a relationship, or it could have been avoided if I had had a better or stronger relationship.
So I think that's interesting because similarly, there are tons of there are tons of sort of religious organizations that are like really springing up into the activism space. And so I always wonder what that looks like as far as like what kinds of frameworks and epistemologies people employ in religious spaces when talking about social justice. How is religion or faith used as sort of the bedrock, say, of the work? And then I think my second question, another question, a tangent and aside, would be how has like COVID really changed the way things work and operate as far as the work being done?
I think the Jewish left gets a lot of criticism from from Orthodox spaces that are more right-wing in particular, but even conservative spaces that are more right-wing for kind of cherry-picking. And I feel like that's what everyone does, right? Like, they're cherry-picking. Like, you know, they're ignoring things like Welcome the Stranger, for example. They can sit at a Passover table and talk about the freedom story and hear Welcome the Stranger 800 times and not feel like that applies to them or where we are in this moment.
Hi, I'm sitting in the room.
Sorry.
You're fine.
It's very weird to live with your parents when you're 37. It's only been a week, but anyway. Right. So like, I think there are so part of what I have found really valuable being someone also who like grew up Jewish, but for many years after like a really negative experience in Israel and feeling like I'd been lied to my whole life, as a teenager, and then, dating a woman and feeling like not that my family or like the congregation I grew up in was so anti, but just like, I don't know. There were just things where before that I actually had thought I was going to be Orthodox. So, I was like very into Judaism, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh, never mind. And so coming into this job, I didn't end up working at a Jewish farm on purpose. It was just, I knew people who said, oh, I'm my friend starting this thing, you should go work there. And I was farming and teaching environmental ed, and that's what they were doing. And similarly, I didn't intend to like work for a Jewish community development organization, but it was just like where I had relationships and that's where I ended up. But starting this job, when I was starting, they were talking about, you know, we do tech study and blah, blah, blah. And I was so like not interested. I was like, ugh, like who wants to do Torah study? Like that's terrible. But I have found a lot of meaning in revisiting texts that I really felt like did not speak to my values and seeing the ways in which it does. And that, for example, we've been working on renters' rights for pretty much the entire time we've been in Baltimore. And it was something I didn't really know anything about before. But we participated in a study of rent court, and we were there and talking to people and hearing their experiences and seeing how unfair the system was. And, you know, having that experience and then looking at text that talks about, like, literally says, like, landlords are responsible for fixing broken windows and locks and for, like, fixing the roof and for, like, actually says that. And says stuff about, like, when you can and cannot evict someone, that you can't evict someone in the rainy season. I think that that would apply to COVID, right? Like, I think if the Torah were being written right now, it would pretty much say, like, you can't evict someone in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I, like, those things have been very meaningful to me personally, and I think similarly are very meaningful to most of the people who are engaged with JOFJ, because I think it's a similar experience for them. Like, I think a lot of folks feel very Jewish and just don't feel like the Jewish communities they've been a part of reflect their values. And JOFJ was, like, one of the first spaces that people had in Baltimore where there was alignment. Mm. So I think text and Jewish tradition plays in immensely. And we really try on all of our campaigns to bring in text to remind people why this is a Jewish value, what we're doing.
Mm.
And in terms of COVID, I mean, honestly, it hasn't changed a ton. Because we work across the state, we already were doing a lot of Zoom calls for our statewide organizing. All of our meetings with our leaders were pretty much on Zoom. Like, every, you know, a couple times a year, we'd have a statewide gathering on a Sunday. But our, you know, regular meetings were on Zoom. So it wasn't a huge shift for us. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's been really challenging is there is, like, navigating our policy about whether we do in-person things or not. It's only recently that we shifted to allow it, like, after the research came out about how the protests, you know, in the uprisings earlier this summer, and really still going on, that, like, that has not contributed to an increase in COVID spread. Mm-hmm. After that came out, my fellow senior leadership team people were more open to encouraging our folks to go to protests or encouraging, but before that, it was not something that we were even telling people about, let alone participating in.
Mm.
And that was hard because it felt like we're a pretty privileged group of people who were staying safe at home, and the people who are really suffering, who are fighting against the forces that are causing them to suffer, are on their own risk, like, taking whatever health risks or whatever, and we're not. Mm-hmm. And I think that continues to be hard. You know, like, there's different mutual aid efforts going on, and we don't do direct service work, but, you know, even, like, door knocking to tell people about a thing or whatever, like, in Howard County, we've been working to end the contract with ICE that the county has to house people for ICE in their detention center. And they wanted, initially we had talked about just, like, hanging door hangers on people's doors in the neighborhood because people don't even know that this exists. But now they're talking about, like, actually knocking on doors and trying to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't feel comfortable with our folks knocking on people's doors. People could come to the door without a mask. Like, there's just, you know, there are risks involved in that where, like, hanging door hangers feels much more low risk. So that has been hard to navigate. We did a really cool, actually, you would probably really like it. We did a modified, you know, like, last year on Tisha B'Av, which is, like, the Jewish day of mourning, it's the ninth day of the Hebrew month of Av, which is in the summer, typically, and not typically, it's in the summer. It, you know, you're sort of, like, mourning all these catastrophes of Jewish history, and we sort of add in, like, and catastrophes of modern day. And last year on Tisha B'Av, we had a huge rally at the detention center. It was actually, like, the first big action related to, and to date is the biggest action that's existed on that campaign. There were somewhere between 300 and 500 people there. And we had a Tisha B'Av service. People read Eicha, the Book of Lamentations, in Hebrew and in English. There was singing, there was a civil disobedience action, blocking the prisoner entrance to the facility. And it was really sad and hard to not be able to replicate that. So instead we did three different actions highlighting three different like modern day catastrophes. So one in Baltimore City with a minion. So, you know, group, a small prayer group, a minion is at least 10 in Orthodox tradition men, but in more egalitarian spaces, 10 people over the age of 13. And so we did three minyanim, one in Baltimore focused on police accountability, one and like mourning police violence and lost life and trauma and all this stuff. One at the Howard County Detention Center focused on family separation and ICE's cruel and inhumane treatment of people. And one, which we did virtually, focused on like statewide, the eviction crisis. You know, right now there's like probably around 330,000 renter households that could be evicted by the end of the year without any action. It's like, it could be like a million people. And no one's doing anything. So the in-person ones we limited to 15 people. So there were like, I don't know, maybe 15 people in Baltimore and maybe a dozen at the Howard County Detention Center. It was very different, but it still felt important to like have a visible action. And one of our leaders created this really beautiful video that I could share with you that highlights each of the three actions and kind of like weaves in comments from different rabbis who participated and from me and some leaders that participated. So yeah, I mean, I think those are like the logistical COVID things. It has also shifted a bit our focus, not entirely. We have been, as I said, working on renter stuff for 6 years. We had sort of started stepping away from it because there really aren't a lot of directly impacted folks leading the work, and we wanted instead to have our efforts, like we were filling a gap where there wasn't that kind of a leadership and like no grassroots support in renters' rights work. But we thought, I thought, and I convinced our leaders to believe as well that we should be instead putting our efforts behind campaigns being led by people who are directly impacted. Even though the renter stuff like certainly impacts communities of color, like there aren't those folks leading the work in any way. So instead we last year prioritized aligning our agenda with Out for Justice, which, you know, organizes returning citizens primarily. And, we worked on like juvenile interrogation bill, and we worked on incarcerated voting rights, and we worked on, police accountability, which we've been working on already. I'm trying to remember what the other thing was, but regardless, in the wake of the pandemic and this economic emergency, we have much more significantly returned to the renters' rights work because it's such a critical need right now. And what's like terrible that this is, there's a need and also really positive in some ways, is that because it's such an acute need for people, organizing groups that haven't historically really worked on housing are now working on housing, and they really have a base. So CASA, for example, you know, they have 100,000 people that they organize, and not in Baltimore, but like in the region. And housing was identified by their leaders, you know, by their members, as the most important thing. So we've been working with them a lot to call for an eviction moratorium, to call for rental assistance, and several other things that would help alleviate the suffering and, you know, potentially prevent evictions for people. So that's been more of a focus. I think that that's the primary COVID related issue shift for us, I would say.
And to just to be clear, and you feel free, you don't have to answer if you don't want to, have you had any actual community members sort of deal with effects of COVID themselves? Mm-hmm. What does it look like providing support or showing up for people who have been like directly affected themselves? Or have you not had to deal with thus far those kinds of things at all?
There are community members that have been sick. There's at least one person who lost a close family member. But I think, I don't know if it's because people aren't talking about it or because, you know, a more white, more affluent community just isn't as impacted as communities of color, which is like real. Mm. I think it's one of the, I think it's one of the reasons that all these like anti-mask white people are like so out of control. Like they don't understand the gravity of the situation because they're not dealing with it. I don't think that, you know, it's not like no white people have been impacted by COVID. The person that I mentioned, who lost an uncle, he was a white guy. I have two friends, who lost both of their parents to COVID. They're, you know, all of them were white. But in JFJ, it's not been something that has come up as like a thing that people are struggling with in a real significant way.
Well, thank you for sharing that. We promised we wouldn't go over an hour and there are 10 minutes left, but we will eventually schedule a sort of a follow-up meeting. And we would love, and I know you said you would send over some of the things that you guys have been doing, and we'll feel free, honestly, we'd love to take a look at it. I think for this just introductory meeting, I think that will be all. Am I missing anything else?
No, I mean, I think that covers it. I think if we have a few more minutes, something that I would love to hear a little bit about is kind of JUFJ's relationship with like the local government in Baltimore. If you guys do any direct work with them, I would love to hear a little bit more about that. I know you mentioned the social justice roundtable with the council members, but if there's any other way that you guys directly work with the government, or if you don't, kind of like your understanding of what the government is doing and what you are doing alongside of that.
Sure. So the roundtable I was talking about is not council members, it's synagogue members.
Okay.
It's like the chairs of the different social justice committees at synagogues. But we do work closely. So JFJ is a 501c3, and we also have a 501c4, which does electoral political work. It's called the JFJ Campaign Fund. And so in the primary, for the first time in Baltimore City, we endorsed candidates for mayor, controller, council president, and many council seats. Over the years, we have really been working to provide spaces where constituents are directly speaking with their elected representatives. At the state level in particular, and more recently at the city level. We actually haven't done a ton of work at the city level until more recently, legislatively, I should say. So at this point, like our leaders, you know, just a really great example from the state work, but I can also share one about city work. I was very sick and I was not able to go to Annapolis. Usually I go, and if we have leaders coming to testify or whatever, I'm there and I support them and like help them navigate, but I was really sick. So this one leader went on her own to testify on a criminal justice bill. I can't remember which one. And I had emailed our partners to say, I can't come. Here's this person's testimony. Can you sign them up to testify and turn in their testimony? I didn't hear back and I was kind of concerned. And after the deadline, they responded, the deadline to sign up, and were like, everyone had forgotten. What bill was this? I can't remember. But ACLU, Public Defender's Office, like everyone had forgotten about this bill. And so we were the only ones who were there. But also, this woman had traveled all this way and her testimony had not been submitted and she was not signed up to testify. But she has hosted her legislators in her home with other JUFJers multiple times. And so she was able to go into the chair of the committee's office, which is her delegate, and speak to his staff member who knew her and was like, she explained what happened. And he was like, don't worry, I'll print out your testimony and turn it in. I'll get you on the list. She was able to get someone from the public defender's office on the list so that somebody else was testifying also. Like, that would not be possible if we hadn't been working over the last 5 years to really develop those relationships. Similarly, Eric Costello in the city, we're not someone we're typically aligned with politically, but he was hosted in one of our members' homes for a house meeting with other constituents to talk about our issues. And, you know, he like was polite and listened and whatever, but at this, you know, there are, he now has developed a relationship with this woman where she can call him and ask him something and he responds. I think this relationship, so we do have close relationships and we endorsed all these candidates through our campaign fund. So I am often in a lot of coalition spaces, one of the people who really has relationships with elected officials and can reach out and help navigate. Like right now we're working to draft two bills at the city level, one on renters' right to counsel, one on this water bill that we passed in November and was supposed to be implemented and the mayor's screwing us over and isn't implementing it and whatever. So it's a bill about getting the bill implemented. I'm able to just like text them or whatever to try to like keep it moving. I think that also poses a challenge. Like it's valuable and also puts us in like a somewhat inappropriate and uncomfortable position of being gatekeepers and trying to figure out always like how do we provide access to our partners, like using these relationships to get them access. Are there people that they can't get a meeting with? Or when we have a meeting, can we make sure that those people that we're working with are invited? You know, with CASA, when the explosion happened in Northwest, I reached out to Lydia Walther Rodriguez, who's their lead Baltimore organizer, because having worked in Northwest, I know that that neighborhood, Falstaff, has the second fastest growing Latinx population in the city. And I know that CASA's, soon after I left, CASA started working there more. So I texted Lydia, I know that street, I know that there's a ton of Latinx immigrant families that live there. And I was like, hey, I just heard about the explosion. It's horrible. Like, I don't know if any of your people were impacted, but like, please let me know how I or other people could be helpful. And she said, you know, thanks, I don't know yet, I'm trying to figure it out. Texted me later and was like, I don't know, people are being, because even the people whose homes were not blown up, like all the other people on that street like had to be evacuated and they were being moved to different places and she didn't know where people were being moved to and there's a language barrier for people and blah, blah, blah. So she said like, I can't get a hold of anyone. Do you know someone, like, can you connect me with someone in the mayor's office or in the council president's office? Because the mayor's office is falling apart as it's a lame duck administration and people are fleeing. So I called the chief of staff for the council president. He got back to me right away. And I just connected the two of them over text, and she was able to then communicate with him directly and get the information she needed to find her people and figure out, you know, where people were going. So it's hard. Those relationships are really valuable to the work. But especially as those relationships, I feel like obviously over time relationships are strengthened and you have more of them and whatever, but like, at this moment, which I would have said last year too, right? At this moment, those relationships are stronger than they've been in the previous years. And I'm having to sort of confront that and figure out how to not be gatekeeping in a way that disempowers the partners that we're working with, and instead increases their power and increases their connections. And that's hard.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I think that also, I think puts into context, like, the different kinds of work that your organization is doing, both like at the government level and working with partner organizations. So thank you for that framing. And it's 2:59. It's just turned 3:00 right now. We want to respect your time. We would love to be able to schedule a follow-up meeting with you for sometime next week. And I will hopefully have an email in your inbox by Monday morning with that. Is it best for us to kind of like continue to reach out to Rhiannon for scheduling?
So the best thing would be, I'm just way better at texting than I am at email. My inbox is just very overwhelming and things get